Welcome back to Accelerando. My name is Paula Tuttle, and today we're continuing our in-depth look at the inventor of the theremin by the Soviet scientist Leon Theremin. When we left off last week, Leon was in New York working with investors to create and mass produce a wide variety of electronic devices. His Teletouch company made instruments that opened doors, turned department store window lights on when pedestrians walked by, and they made alarms for various things when people came in close proximity. In March of 1932, the world was obsessed with the Lindbergh baby's kidnapping. So Theremin's response to the crime of the century? He constructed an alarm to go around the crib. His designs were so whimsical, but they were intriguing. So here's one. An elaborate alarm system that sends a signal to the police when the homeowner puts up his hands during the intrusion or a stick-up. It sounds very Batman-like. Also, fire alarms that responded to sudden increases in temperature. And warnings for vessels enveloped in fog. Applications for trains approaching each other. A lot of these were really useful ideas. So while the inventor was distracted from building his musical instruments, the world responded by making their own theremins as instructions on how to build them from scratch were being published. The design was the usual antennas and a volume control pedal placed near any ordinary radio receiver using the speaker, and an amplifier and a high-frequency oscillator. So while the inventor was kind of strapped for money and situations, his friend Lucy Rosen put in a good word to her neighbor, John D. Rockefeller. She was suggesting that he include a lab for the inventor in the Radio City Music Hall and the Rockefeller Center being built. But meanwhile, her husband wanted Theremin out of the building that he was using for his lab and residence. It seems the couple had different relationships with the inventor. At the same time, Theremin's student Clara Reisenberg was devoting all her time and energy to practicing the theremin, and she was gearing up for her New York debut on the instrument. She practiced violin etudes on the theremin to perfect her technique. Clara was so invested in the theremin, and Theremin was in love with Clara, even though he was still married to Katya. He proposed to Clara. Apparently, none of the theremin acquaintances remembered that Theremin was married either. But he was to be turned down, even though Clara did consider marrying him. She instead accepted a proposal from a famous lawyer and producer, Robert Rockamore. So Theremin was emotionally devastated, and he cut off all ties with Clara. And that's too bad, because Clara was a rising star, and Theremin could have benefited from association with her and her husband. But Theremin would remarry anyways, just not his paramour. He soon married Lavinia Williams, a ballet dancer who would perform with the American Ballet Theater in the 40s. And she worked with Agnes DeMille and George Balanchine. But during the years with Theremin, she was dancing with the American Negro Ballet. I guess he was now married to two women. Katya's story is also in Glinsky's biography. She was working at a hospital in New York. The two were estranged, put things simply. I guess there's nothing simple about Theremin's life. And at this time, Theremin's instrument continued to get attention from composers. Edgar Varèse began to incorporate the theremin in his works. In 1933, the premiere of Equatorial was sponsored by the Pan American Composers Association, with Henry Cowell as president, and Charles Ives was a major funder. So the theremin was being taken pretty seriously as a musical instrument in the classical musical world. Even though Clara Reisenberg shuddered at the kind of effects composers Varèse elicited from the theremin, she had spent long hours getting the pitches centered and getting away from the glissandos that Varèse was focusing on. And Varèse probably didn't think he needed a virtuoso playing the theremin in his orchestra, so he used the sounds a layman theremist could evoke. The sliding sounds were more easily played. Later, when the work was published, he switched the theremin parts to another electronic instrument, one that was created by another cellist, Maurice Martineau. The instrument was patented in 1928 also, but it was a keyboard instrument that imitated the cello too. Martineau was a radio operator during World War I, and he noticed the accidental overlap of tones between military radio oscillators, and ultimately, he created an instrument where the player wears a metal ring on the right index finger while playing a keyboard instrument said to be a cross between an organ and a theremin. Was the theremin superior to the one made by Martineau? Well, under Clara Reisenberg's technique, it was amazing. Her debut in New York included pieces like Berceuse from Stravinsky's Firebird, Lalo's Symphonie Espagnole, works by Bach, Tchaikovsky, Glazunov, and Ravel. The slide from one note to the next was eliminated by her wonderful technique. Her legato style was heralded as virtuosic, and she proved the theremin had a rightful place among the traditional instruments. 3 months later, Lucy Rosen had a New York debut too. She played music of Strauss, Wagner, Debussy, and Vinyasky. And her costume publicity portrait was stylishly embodying the serif nature of the music. Mrs. Rosen captured the public's attention in a different way. Her performance was just as stunning as Clara's. You could say Lucy's awareness of popular culture benefited her execution of the instrument. But both women were completely in control of the instrument, virtuosos in both respects. And so, we haven't talked much about Theremin's role as a Soviet in the U.S. All while he was in New York, Theremin was made to rendezvous with the same two Russian consulate men in gray hats. They met at a cafe in New York, and they always made him drink two glasses of vodka before they began their debriefing. In other words, Theremin had to check in periodically and divulge whatever he learned about military secrets, especially what he heard about dimensions inside of aircraft and other details. So Theremin had learned to eat a lot of butter, a couple sticks of butter, before meeting with the men, so the alcohol wouldn't make him incapacitated, which is exactly what the Russian thugs wanted the vodka to do. Theremin had been finding information about American innovation while creating his inventions. So he'd be talking to airline companies, for example, and Theremin would suggest an idea, and the company would invariably divulge their military secrets about airplanes. He'd become really good at getting these companies to open up. The scientist/inventor had more skill sets than we even knew. His ability to woo the Rosens and RCA, and to shape his public persona, and now the ruse to get military secrets. Theremin was a genius, yes, but capable on so many levels. How did he get the airline technicians to divulge the kind of information the Soviets were interested in? Theremin said that when you show something of your own, it's easier to find out what other people are working on. Theremin had some very ingenious ideas of his own for the airplane, which included autopilot and remote control devices. And after mentioning these thoughts to the airline companies they were talking to, they told him about their inventions in these fields. So Theremin was maybe bluffing, but this was how he extracted the secrets, and then he told them to the Russians. But by now, Leon was living in the U.S. on borrowed time. His original non-immigrant status visa was renewed every 6 months, and he was being viewed by the Labor Department with raised eyebrows, especially after he went to Havana on a business trip in 1935. Once again, Theremin was using shifty tactics to maneuver whatever systems he needed to work. When the U.S. didn't want to let him re-enter from Cuba, traveled to Canada, and he applied for immigration through the Canadians. Meanwhile, the Cubans were installing Theremin's teletouch devices. They bought his alarm systems and perimeter devices, and the U.S. continued to look less favorably at the scientists' visa renewals. So as Theremin was looking at an expiring visa and increasing financial woes, he was definitely living on borrowed money and time, and he failed to make good on large loans. Theremin attempted to shelter the teletouch company by creating a certificate for incorporation of essentially the same company, Teletouch Industries Incorporated. While the original Teletouch Corporation was in hot water, this new version allowed them to continue transacting business. Or they tried. By the spring of 1938, Thurman was so far underwater, he began to consider going home. Later on, he admitted, "Of course I was here on assignment all along, but the assignments dealt with unseemingly unimportant issues for military purposes." Wait, what? So Thurman thought about returning to Russia, but Russia was changing. Would he be able to return to his quiet life as a lab scientist? So on August 31st, 1938, he signed over his assets in the company to his partner. And the next day, the ocean liner from Russia that would take him home eventually, it docked in New Jersey. And 8 days later, Thurman finished the most advanced version of the theremin for Lucy Rosen. And he sat down with her and gave her instructions on how to find replacement parts because he knew his departure was imminent. But he only knew it himself. He didn't tell anybody else, not his wife, not his friends. No one was in possession of the knowledge that Thurman planned to leave the country. Getting out of U.S. was tricky for him because, it comes as no surprise, he owed some income taxes. And the IRS would put a halt to his departure. But the Russians had methods in place to remove their people and their spies. They used genealogy records available to them. And they just outfitted Leon with another passport. They actually forged the Siemens records and listed him as a crew member of the Starý Bolshevik. So on September 15th, when Thurman left his home with the men who came for him, his wife, Lavinia, was told he was leaving and was instructed she was not coming with him. He told her he would be in touch. She said maybe he was concerned for her safety, but the truth is she was devastated and he never sent for her. So Thurman executed his exit in utter secrecy and he took all his equipment, all his plans, all his notes, all of his instruments. And all his friends, when they went up to his studio, they were astonished that it was empty. The exit was planned. He took everything with him that related to his inventions. Any writings, any descriptions, and all the equipment had been packed up and taken with the inventor. Then he arrived at the ship in New Jersey, and it was outfitted with 24 crewmen, the same number that were on the ship when it arrived. But were any of them the same? Or were there just 24 Soviets escaping the U.S.? The U.S. government was more concerned with the numbers than the names, and this was how Thurman escaped the country. And in hindsight, the timing was perfect because travel was being shut down to Europe in the face of war, and Americans were being called home. Maybe it was out of the frying pan and into the fire. And you have to feel a little sympathy for Thurman. There he stood on the deck looking back on his adventurous life, where he enjoyed personal success and fame among the wealthy, where his work was well known, and where he was able to be creative. Now, on the ship headed for Russia, he was smuggled among proletarian workers like chefs, firemen, barkeepers. His future wouldn't have any more fame. He would become a regular person. And maybe he left something in America, at least his reputation. You know, the Green Hornet was broadcast every Thursday night on the radio.
The Green Hornet strikes again. Hurry, Tato, we're out to smash a parking lot racket.
And the theremin was in the theme song. And at the New York World's Fair that summer, they would feature a lot of theremin's inventions, including the cradle alarm and some mirrors that had trick illusions. But the company that Thurman left to Zinman, his partner, and the technical papers Thurman left for Lucy Rosen all turned out to be worthless. Once again, Leon had turned the thing on their head. He left nothing of worth behind when he escaped. The latest Thurman schematics he wrote down with Lucy days before his departure didn't hold any real clues or information how to maintain or rebuild. Poof. Up in smoke. And same with the company. Nothing of real value is left. The magician has left the building. So Thurman arrives in Leningrad, and he must have been shocked because things have really changed since he left, with Stalin in charge. But nothing prepared him for what he saw. No longer did people openly welcome or recognize him. There was no fanfare. There were no pressing crowds or craning necks. People were frightened, and they didn't make any overtures of any kind. People just tried to be invisible. This was Stalin's age, and the people were gloomy, and their faces were dead. And the sad part, really, is that there was nothing to return to. A lot of his family was gone, his home was gone, and his friends were no longer friendly. And his office, his friends at his office, they just gave him a cold reception. Pretty soon, Lev, taking back his Russian name, understood what he'd returned to. The unannounced middle-of-the-night searches and arrests that began under Lenin were now standard procedure under Stalin. Whatever started under Lenin was exponential now under Stalin. And anyone who tried to discuss it or debate it in any manner was considered a traitor and might be shot for treason. Ugh. Couldn't Leon or Lev have just paid a few taxes and kept his life in America? Or would the Russians have taken him anyways, one of their prized scientists, and with the war on the threshold? This is the question, and the general opinion, or my opinion, is Lev would have been coerced to return. Even though he didn't have family in Russia, they would have extracted him. Now, anyone who wants the really gritty history of life in Russia at this point in time, Glinsky's book gives a clear explanation of what went on with the NKVD and the executions and the genocide under Stalin. But this podcast is supposed to be about music, and how did we wander so far astray?
I was about to ask the same thing. Can we wrap this up?
Okay, so I'll fast forward a bit. So Lev was unemployed, and he tried to meet with former associates, but like 1 in 20 Russian citizens, he eventually found himself in prison. All his musical equipments and other inventions were seized. And then he went under interrogation for days. His ties to radio technology actually made him a sitting duck in the eyes of Stalin. He was viewed as a saboteur and an enemy of the people because of his work outside the Soviet Union. And that's crazy. They had him under their thumb all along.
This is depressing.
I'll say. He was found for treason against the motherland. He was convicted under Article 58, meaning a political offender or coveting aid to the international bourgeois. He was given 8 years for nothing. He was sent to a camp for imprisonment in the coldest region, a camp 4 times the size of France. But you know, pretty soon the Russians realized they have a war at hand and they needed to catch up with Germany, and they had just put all of their scientists in concentration camps. So, somehow Lev came to be noticed for his scientific achievements in a way other than the political stamp he wore as a prisoner. He was summoned to Moscow a good ways into his sentence. And when he arrived, he was sent to another prison, but it was more like the Four Seasons Hotel in comparison. He was served a meal like he hadn't seen in years. Cocoa meat macaroni were served, and they called it the Dream Prison. They only wanted the inmates to do mental work. These prisons were called Sharashkas, and they did super secret work in closed research institutes for imprisoned scientists. So Lev was still doing slave labor, but it was secret government projects. And now Lev's assignments were in aeronautics. He was among 150 other scientists that were on a list of probably 3 times that number of prisoners it took months to find in the various camps. Even though he had little expertise in the area, the Russians were kind of desperate. The war with Germany made them realize they had squandered a lot of their resources, put most of them in prison, and the need for innovation to match Germany, well, Russia had fallen well behind. It was kind of a Hail Mary. A cobbled-together group of scientists were given the task of improving the airplanes and technology the Russians had pretty much ignored for a decade or more. So the war pretty much saved Lev. He was put in the most horrible of all the prisons, and then he was retrieved because he was a scientist. One of the instruments Lev had done work with in his teletouch days was an altimeter, and this was where he was really valuable in his projects with the Soviets. And he also worked on landing gear and some remote control devices for guns under the planes.
Were the theremin musical instruments ever relevant in the airplane technology?
I'm glad you asked that. Actually, they were installed to help mount the wings of airplanes. It was easier for engineers to hear the adjustments, so Theremin left a gift for the American war effort after all.
Really? That's pretty cool.
So Lucy and Clara continued to do their concerts, and in 1944, Stokowski commissioned a concerto for Clara to play on Theremin. And other composers were writing for it, too. Martineau wrote a fantasy for Theremin, oboe, piano, and string quartet. Percy Grainger seized upon the instrument and created special notation to prescribe the kinds of slides the instrument could make. And now Alfred Hitchcock was going to use the instrument for the music in a thriller, Spellbound. And Clara was asked to play a very difficult part, but she declined. She said she didn't want to be associated with Hollywood, and even more, she didn't want to be using it as a sound effect.
And Clara and Lucy knew nothing of what the inventor was going through.
And that's exactly right. So just about now, Theremin was assigned to build a contraption that would hang in the American Embassy in Moscow. It was called the Spazo House. And it was to have no wires and no traditional microphones, and it had to be encased in something that wouldn't draw attention to itself. And then how did they get the secret listening device into the office? So Lev was able to do all of this. Once again, the magician worked his wonders in a form of a Trojan horse. On a July 4th celebration, a delegation of Boy Scouts, the Soviet version, presented a wall plaque that looked like a scout project and had a great seal of United States in relief. It was offered as a gesture of friendship.
Funny.
Averell Harriman thanked the scouts and hung the plaque right over his desk. Unwittingly, he had placed Lev's latest invention, one that fused his knowledge of capacitors from the early work before the Theremin box, to his burglar alarms and space control devices at the Teletouch Company. And Harriman couldn't have placed it more strategically if he tried. The device inside the seal was about the size of a quarter, and it was passive. It went undetected when X-rayed at the entrance to the American Embassy. And when microwaves were aimed at it from the building across the street from Spazo House, the cylinder inside the plaque resonated as a miniature tuned circuit. Kind of brilliant. Lev was ideal for this job because he had been working with tuned circuits in his keyboard instruments and all his space-controlled instruments. And as a radio technician, too, he knew to pick the right frequency, one the Americans didn't utilize. So after the huge success of installing the thing, as it was later dubbed by the Americans, Lev was enlisted to create another eavesdropping system dubbed Snowstorm. But no device would be planted in the embassies it was pointed at. Lev had to devise a method that utilized the structure's resonating components, the floors, the walls, the window panes, and such. And then he directed an infrared beam at the window glass, and he was able to direct or reflect the ray back to an infrarometer that could interpret conversations. This system worked up to 1,600 feet and was used on the American, French, and British embassies in Moscow. So his sentence was ending very soon, but then his handler asked him to spy on Stalin. And Lev's handler was the NKVD police chief, Lavrenty Beria, and Beria was a bad one. Everyone was concerned about their standing with Stalin, including Beria, and everybody was paranoid because there was no telling what Stalin would do on one day or another. So yeah, Beria got Lev to do some eavesdropping on Stalin. And the inventor was in so deep, he couldn't say no to the police chief. And either way, it was an act of treason. So it was more than miraculous that he was released at all. A few scientists were released. And in Theremin's case, his release from his imprisonment was met with him receiving the Stalin Prize. Like the Nobel Prize, the Stalin Prize recognized achievement in science, arts, and other fields. Shostakovich received the Stalin Prize in 1942 for his Seventh Symphony. But the Stalin Prize was usually awarded for propaganda materials in literature or cinematography. Theremin was nominated for his work on the Snowstorm Project. The official term was Buran, which means gale force. Later on, a space mission carried the same name. And it's a funny twist because it was Stalin that gave the final okay on the prize. It was supposed to be a level 2 prize, and Stalin actually crossed out the 2 and changed it to Level 1, the highest decoration Russia bestowed on Soviet innovators. And I say funny, because Theremin's handler made the scientists use the device on Stalin himself. So Stalin initiated the top award to the man who facilitated the eavesdropping on Stalin himself. And the award came with some serious cash, like the equivalent of $20,000 in 1947, and a two-room apartment in Moscow. So life after that was weird for Lev. He was used to being told when to get up, when to sleep, when to work. So he went back to the labs, and he worked with the scientists that were trying to catch up on nuclear science. So it was the Soviet version of the Manhattan Project. Yuck. Then he asked if his wife, Lavinia, could move to Moscow. And that was a hard no. They said, get married again to someone in the secretarial pool at the lab. And he did just that. He married a 26-year-old Maria Gushina, and they had twins a year later. More yuck. Let's fast forward. 1950, Stalin dies. And then comes Khrushchev, which is confusing to put in any sense. He declared Stalin the greatest in 1952, and then pronounces him the worst in 1957. At least he steered the country away from the terror-ridden years under Stalin. The effort to rehabilitate the country also meant historical revision, rewriting what happened. People were even instructed to tear pages out of the encyclopedias. That's about as literal as it gets for historical revisionism. So about the time Sputnik launched, Lev's eavesdropping device in the Moscow American Embassy was discovered by the Americans. It had been working beautifully for 7 years. And the CIA, when they got their hands on it, they were pretty impressed with the level of sophistication and elegance behind the whole passive technology. The Americans, they tested the Eagle, and they now dubbed it the Thing, and they couldn't figure out how it worked. They knew it was a listening device because they accidentally intercepted the signal one day. They heard the conversation in the ambassador's office over the radio. But after they seized it and examined it, they were scratching their heads. They struggled to figure out how it actually worked. To the CIA, the device was impossible. So they turned it over to the British version of the CIA. In the hands of the Brits, they were only able to replicate the Thing with a suitcase full of equipment, and it took them 18 months to do it. Now the Americans sensed they needed to up their game if they were going to prevail in the Cold War. They scrambled to copy the Thing for their own purposes under the code name Easy Chair. But the project just wasn't successful. No one was able to copy the Russian inventor's device in the small and simple, elegant way that he did. And the Americans just came up empty-handed. And the Russians, they denied the existence of the device. So Theremin's instrument was still being discovered by audiences, and Lucy was still concertizing around the U.S. and Europe. But people were getting less enthusiastic about her performances. And maybe the Theremin was waning. Lucy's last concert was in 1953. There was a new rising star on the Theremin, Samuel Hoffman. He played on Hitchcock's Spellbound, and Hoffman became a celebrity on TV shows like Truth or Consequences and Jack Paar and a bunch of other places through 1960. Then, Time magazine declared the Theremin the industry's most fashionable musical device. It was in 1951 a 15-year-old Robert Moog read about the Theremin. By age 19, he started a company out of his bedroom selling Theremins. He assembled them by hand, about 15 of them. And he eventually created the version we know today, the Moog Theremin. The Theremins you buy today are the Moog Theremini, and they look so much different from the one the Theremin played. I actually saw one that looked like the one the Theremin played at a concert that Roger Zahab conducted at the University of Pittsburgh. They played a piece called Dracula. In the 50s, the Theremin became a staple in the movies and television recordings. So here it is in The Day the Earth Stood Still. So no one in any of the American circles heard anything from Theremin for 25 years. And it was Clara Rockmore and her husband who decided to visit Russia in 1962. They were at a party and they casually asked about Theremin. This scientist says, "I had lunch with them today." And Clara just fainted. So she managed to get a meeting arranged with Theremin. And it was very strange. It was like in a subway. And then Lev arranged a very surreptitious get-together that meant them both going to the opera, and then they both leave at the same time and get swept into a cab. And he takes them to their apartment, and they run up the stairs, not the elevator, because everybody's spying on him all the time. And then she finally got to meet his family, his daughters, and his wife. Clara had said that the depth of his covert hospitality indicated he was still punching the top-secret government time clock. Lev was still working for the KGB. But his work had taken a strange turn. They wanted him to study UFOs, aliens, and telepathy. In 1964, Theremin was allowed to retire from the KGB and seek out some relatives. So at 68, he published a book about physics and the development of electronical music instruments. And his new version of the theremin could alter notes with the shift of eyes. He had lenses trained on the performer's eyes, and when the player's eyes moved to a different lens, a different note played. Brilliant. And then there was another system for swaying of the head. He even attempted to control volume through thought processes. The ESP work, I guess, paid off. And after that eavesdropping device that he made, the one that was in the ambassador's office, when you think about how far ahead it was of everything the Americans and the rest of the world were doing, some of these things seem pretty believable. ESP, thought processes changing the volume. That's pretty wild. In 1967, Harold Schoenberg met Theremin at the Moscow Conservatory. And up until then, most of the world knew nothing of Theremin since he disappeared in 1938. Most people thought he was dead. Schoenberg got a tour of the inventor's lab. He was shown all these instruments, an electronic organ that tuned itself, a rhythmicon which played complex rhythms, a machine that slowed down music without altering pitch, a machine that analyzed the pedaling styles of different pianists, and then Theremin played a Chopin piece for Theremin on his latest model. And then finally, he unveiled a room where Theremin just stood in the middle with no instrument, lifted his arms, and played Massenet Elegy on nothing. No wires or gadgets were visible anywhere. And the room filled with music. Schoenberg called it the electromagnetic sorcery. Schoenberg's article in the April 26, 1967 New York Times was titled "Music, Leon Theremin." And it not only announced Leon Theremin was alive, but also resurrected his reputation. His old friends were now shocked to hear he was alive, and they had an address that they could write to him. So letters started pouring into his lab, and the music conservatory wasn't pleased, and Moscow wasn't pleased either. At some point, the idea of electricity for music was determined to be against Russian ideology, and well, all of Theremin's instruments were destroyed, and Theremin was dismissed from the conservatory. So ironically now, music became his secret work. He continued to work on instruments in a lab he constructed in his apartment. But he was allowed to leave Russia to go speak at festivals. He went to France, he went to New York and Stockholm, went to Brussels. His life after retirement was very productive, and he became popular in the Western world again. At 98 years old, Leon finally took his last breath. He left this world. He went in his sleep peacefully on November 2nd, 1993, and it was just a day after a BBC documentary on the inventor aired. It was a fitting tribute to a life that was creative and prolific, even if it wasn't always peaceful. Leon really did leave a mark on the world in both music and physics. The dreamer gave us a lot of inventions, the first of them from sound waves bouncing off of each other. In Russian, his name was Theremin. We say the H in English. So a palindrome of Theremin, and then backwards of Theremin, in Russian actually says, "Theremin does not die." So there we end our tale of the Russian cellist slash scientist. It does cast a gloomy picture of the life in Russia.
What about his wives? He had three of them?
Well, nearly four. He was actually married to three wives at the same time.
What's the deal with number four?
Yeah, when Maria, wife number three, died, he wanted to marry again. But the government put some kind of a waiting period on the marriage, and the girl threw herself off a building.
I'm sorry I asked. He was quite the Casanova.
Apparently so. Except while in prison, of course. Thanks for being with us this week. And speaking of gloomy Russian tales, the Pittsburgh Opera is presenting Denys and Katya, a modern opera by Philip Venables. Philip was at rehearsals this week helping us tweak the performance with the opera resident artists Jasmine Awalia and Brendan Bell. There's four celli on the stage with the two singers. And this is a story about two teenagers. They get in trouble. They're in a standoff with the special Russian forces. Ugh. The whole thing is very chilling. But you might want to catch this one. It's so contemporary and very much a story for the information age. So see you at the Bits Opera Factory, perhaps. Let me know if you need more info. Until then, thanks for supporting live music, and I'll see you soon.